And the biggest problem with this model, there are a number of them, there are a number of benefits as well, but the biggest problem is that this was an idea of human habitation and community built entirely to the scale and the needs of automobiles. And what that means is that whether we like it or not, we have all become deeply dependent on automobiles, the internal combustion engines that drive them, to get from point A to point B, which is part of the reason why we have this extraordinarily huge and growing carbon footprint, and why we find ourselves facing down an existential threat to humanity. So I just wanted, that's where we got to for very logical reasons. And I think that's one of those things when we talk about cities, there tends to be this, same as it used to be cities versus country, now it's urban versus suburban. It's all, you know, a logical product of the industrial economy driven by fossil fuel, liberated from time and distance to some degree by the tools we wrought. And of course, the difficulty now is that we have to figure out a way to reimagine it on the fly, 7 billion of us, with basically the same needs and wants. And Paul Hawken, who's considered sort of the godfather of sustainable business, he was speaking to a university class a few years ago. I think he got the scale right. Civilization needs a new operating system. You are the programmers, and we need it within a few decades. And that's a pretty tall order. The important thing I think to take from this is that Hawken is not talking about, in a sense, changing what the machine does. Civilization still needs to be civilization. It still needs to provide for 7 billion and growing of us on the planet. We still will have the same human needs and expectations. We're not talking about a reversal of the last 150 years of industrial society so much as a building of a new foundation for them. And I had to sort of make a choice. I could have spent the rest of this talk discussing the foundation at an energy level, but I thought it was actually much more useful, because we're talking about land ethic, to talk about cities as part of that sustainable consciousness, as a place where it can grow and thrive, in fact. But I did want to begin by saying that we have, really from a technological point of view, cracked the operating system piece of it. We can run great, big, large, modern industrial societies on renewable energy predominantly. It is not simple. There are challenges, but as you know, Germany, and this is a very typical German countryside picture nowadays, shows, the resources are there. There is a way to develop a land ethic that includes large-scale industrial energy production and does not further deepen the problem of climate change. Germany, just to put a number on it, has gone from less than 5% of its electricity coming from renewable sources to more than 20%, actually around 26% as we speak, in about 12 years. Against all of the best estimates of energy economists the world over, because this stuff simply works. But I don't want to dwell on how we make energy. That is something, certainly if you want to talk to me afterward, I'd be happy to talk your ear off about. But I really wanted to talk about the land ethic, in a sense, of cities. And the problem with the land ethic of cities is that we've basically built that environment, as I said, for the needs of the automobile. This is not an accident. What happens, this is Deerfoot Trail in Calgary. It's a mess almost every day, but it is not an accident. Everything we have done in terms of urban design, urban layout, neighborhood design, where we put the schools in proximity to the workplaces, in proximity to the houses, has told people in a million ways, conscious and unconscious, this is how you use your space. This is the best use of what is ultimately a public space, the street. Get in your car, go from one private space to another in a kind of imitation of a private space that is the vehicle itself. This is what cities are for. This is the message that we are saying over and over and over again. And you can see it, you know, when you look at the large scale of this. This is a very typical northern, you know, North Calgary suburb. Everything in that picture was designed to make it pleasant and comfortable and safe to be in an automobile traveling quickly. The roads, those curvilinear roads, those sort of swooping, sweeping roads of a suburban neighborhood, are built to a width and dimension to be safe at 80 kilometers an hour. Whatever the speed limit is on them, they will feel perfectly safe to you traveling 80 kilometers an hour in your car. 80 kilometers an hour is not a speed where the street belongs to anything but the car. And that really, I think, is the problem, is we've forgotten that cars and people don't have the same needs. And just to kind of, you know, overstate the point, I thought I'd give you the most extreme example I've run into. It's one that I've gotten to know quite well, which is the parking lot of the Alberta Children's Hospital in Calgary. Brand new, state-of-the-art hospital, millions spent on it, years in the planning, lots of smart people talking about how this hospital was going to be a great place for kids to come and get well. And once you go in that entrance, it is a wonderful, welcoming environment. It's bright, the halls are wide, there's lots of room for kids to move around, there's a giant aquarium in the main atrium, there's a piano to play, some fantastic playgrounds, and obviously the best medical care we can provide. But as soon as you arrive at the Alberta Children's Hospital and go to park your car, you are in the midst of an environment that is openly hostile to children moving around on their feet or otherwise. This is a building that was built with the intention of being a receiving place for kids with mobility problems, kids in wheelchairs, kids who can't see or hear, parents who are anxious, scared, not sure what's going to happen next, kids in strollers. And yet the entire design of the parking garage puts you in a hostile environment the moment you park. Even the spaces that would be, at least if not pleasant, safe for a kid in a wheelchair or a kid in a stroller, have been basically taken over by signage for the ease of cars. So this would be not bad had they not put the signs in the way. Now it's too narrow to get a kid in a wheelchair through. And this is just an extreme example, I guess, of how deeply the logic of fossil fuel and motor vehicles has sort of infected the way we think about habitat, about land, and about our ethic on that land. And so what I'd like to do is talk about how we begin to reverse that conversation. And how we begin, first of all, to reimagine the public spaces in our communities and then to reinvigorate them with some of the other ideas that you've been talking about all day today, this idea of a much more careful, sustainable land ethic. I do think you begin in a lot of communities, anything larger than a village, anything at urban scale, with the integrity of the public space that is the street. If you are building habitat for human beings, the street needs to be, by design, safe and welcoming to people who are in cars, on bikes, on foot, however they come, wherever they're going. And this is a great example of the beginning of rethinking urban design that came out of the problems of suburbia. This is a new urbanist community in Florida. Everything about this was designed to be a shared space. So even though there's a posted speed limit, you would never go faster than about 20 or 30 kilometers an hour on these streets because you would feel like a maniac doing so. There's 1,000 different cues in the landscape to tell you slow down, there are people around, there are going to be kids playing, people on bikes, people stopping to talk at the corner, which actually does happen because the cars are moving slower. Even though there's no clearly delineated spaces in the way that we sometimes now do in our cities and towns where everything's been painted a different color and there's 1,000 different signs, it's just simply the way the landscape is designed. And the next iteration of this was to basically see how we could build it out at larger urban scale. This is a very typical new urbanist community in suburban Denver. Interesting because what you're looking at used to be a shopping mall parking lot, and they went and built it downtown for one that had never had one in a city called Lakewood outside of Denver. The other interesting thing about it is that really what they've built is a scale model replica of all the downtowns we used to build right up until World War II across North America. You know, you've got people living and working above shops. You've got a nice wide sidewalk to move up and down, some street trees to provide warmth and cover and a little bit of protection. Really, all the stuff we used to do as a matter of course in building human habitation until we decided that the only purpose of a street was for cars. And what's come out of this new urbanist movement and some of the other ideas of rethinking urban space has been this fantastic flowering of 1,000 little projects. You go to almost any city in North America now and you'll find some little group of people, either sanctioned or unsanctioned, doing amazing things to bring human scale and a land ethic in some ways back to those urban spaces where it's been so terribly denuded. And so I'll take you through a few examples of those and then show you how they all come together. One of my favorites is San Francisco's Parking Day movement. And what this started as a completely unsanctioned kind of guerrilla theater thing where a bunch of activists got together and said, let's reclaim one day a year, reclaim some parking spots, just to demonstrate on the landscape what parking spots could be if they weren't all for cars. And the idea was not no more parking spots. It was that an extraordinary amount of our land now within the urban sphere is given over to making sure that everywhere you go, there's a parking spot waiting for you. And this is not, to my mind, a particularly noble use of urban space. And what they did was demonstrate you could have a little park on any one of those. The city liked it so much that they started sanctioning them, which allowed them to get a little bit more architecturally interesting and multi-use. A single parking spot or two, and suddenly you've got an outdoor cafe. And it's interesting, actually, when we travel to cities that have great public space. You know, we go, for example, to a European capital, where most of it was built prior to the arrival of the automobile. And you talk to people, for example, who go to Europe on vacation, and they tell you what they did on their vacation. They went to this museum or that landmark. But really what they did on their vacation was live in great urban space. They talk about sitting at cafes, sitting at the plaza, walking the streets, using that perfect space that was built to human scale. And I think that's part of what this movement is bringing back, is the idea that as human beings, in cities or out, we want to be able to sit out. We want to be in the fresh air. We want to see other people. We maybe want a tree nearby for some shade and some color. All the same stuff that you want in a rural environment as well. The idea is not simply to have purpose-built parks, but to let that sort of multi-use space pervade the entire city. You can see other examples of this. I like to give a Canadian example. So this is a temporary sidewalk that doubles the width of the sidewalk in Halifax, Nova Scotia. This allows, during the summer months, the exact same thing, multi-use of the space. You get a few planters along the way to give it a bit of life, and people can sit out during those precious months when it's warm and bright enough to do so in this country. Every single time, I often think, but as a quick side note, you know, whenever there's a great Stanley Cup race in Canada, the city that it's hosted in loses its mind, and there's, you know, parties in the streets and the rest of it. And part of that, I think, is the enthusiasm we have for hockey. But part of it is because it's just gotten warm enough to do that. And people have the sanction, the sort of unofficial sanction, to run wild in the streets and reclaim that space because it's hockey. And you can't, you know, nothing else would allow that, but hockey, you can do that. So that's something to keep in mind. The really powerful thing here is when you put all of this together into what urban designers, urban planners call a complete street, you take all these little elements of what a human scale habitat looks like and you build a complete street in your community. And the great thing about this is we're now seeing, you know, grassroots scale reinventions of urban space to these complete street standards. My favorite, really, you know, if I was to point you to a single example of, you know, how do you begin the conversation about urban sustainability, about using your urban space better, I would point you to this terrible block of Oak Cliff in Dallas, Texas, and the brilliant bunch of people who came together to build a better block on that block. And it's a terrific story, really, in every detail. Oak Cliff was a very, very down-at-heel neighborhood. Not far from central Dallas. It was an old suburb. It had obviously been completely gutted of all of its usual urban infrastructure. This main street was basically just a throughway for high-speed commuter traffic. By the time in the late 90s, early aughts, that people started to reinvestigate and notice that there were some great old buildings, there were some nice storefronts, a bike shop opened up, a bookstore opened up. But there were all kinds of crazy things going on with the land use. As you can see in the picture, on one side you're allowed to have a retail space, but on the other you're not. At some point they decided that other side was industrial land, only industrial activity. And so the folks who were trying to reinvigorate that street realized, if we go to City Hall and say, what we want to do is narrow the roadway, slow down the traffic, put in street trees, put in cafe space, put a bike lane down, and basically turn the whole block upside down, they would be laughed at City Hall. No City Hall is going to listen to a bunch of crazy people who want to do that. But if we go and we say we want to have a block party, it's going to be a street festival celebrating art, and one of the art projects is called Building a Better Block, we might just get away with it. And so that's exactly what they did. They, less than $1,000, not a single professional urban designer in the place, and they created great human habitat in the center of a down-at-heel neighborhood in Dallas, Texas, for just one weekend. And you can see very, very simple tools, some donated chairs and tables, a few potted plants to give that cover, and really demonstrated more than anything to this community that you could have a very different conversation about the kind of community you wanted to live in very quickly if you could simply find the space to come together and talk about it. And I think that's the one of the things we forget. You know, I'm going to talk a lot about Copenhagen in a minute, and Jan Gehl, who's the great sort of guru of Copenhagen design, likes to say, there's a reason why in the U.S. Constitution, one of the first rights that's granted is the right to free assembly. And that's because it's recognized as the absolute lifeblood of democracy, and it presumes the existence of free public space to do so. And that's really one of the things that I think we don't have enough of. In any case, this is the before and after, just so it's really clear. That's the same block. before and after. This was so successful and so well documented. Go, Google Better Block Oak Cliff, Dallas on YouTube, and you'll find a fantastic 8-minute document. The Better Block movement, really without anyone intending it to, went viral, moved from city to city across the United States. Here's a flyer for a Better Block just a year later in Fort Lauderdale. We've seen better blocks. This one is in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Again, the same idea. Cheap materials, temporary, donated, quick and easy, demonstrating to the people in this particular part of the city that their street could be something more than a way for cars to get from one place to another. Same thing happened in, this is an even simpler one, in Wichita, Kansas. I mean, these are really, really simple materials. Not a permanent solution, but a really great kind of catalyst to a new kind of conversation about what kind of space we want in our cities. And I would argue a great way to begin the conversation that leads to that grail, that city on a hill named Copenhagen, which is not actually on a hill, where the carbon footprint is 80% smaller than the average North Americans. And the reason it is 80% smaller is not just because Copenhagen is in Denmark and the Danes are big on wind energy and energy efficiency and district heating and all that kind of stuff, though they are, but really because your average Copenhagener does not need that much in the way of fossil fuel to live his or her life. And they began, to be clear, from pretty much the same spot we find ourselves in. This is it today, by the way. Regularly tops most livable city lists, sustainable city lists, all that kind of thing. But they began from the place we find ourselves in, which is basically choking on your own exhaust, total gridlock, the streets so crowded with cars that you needed to get the people hoarded over onto the one side there. In fact, and this is in the late 1950s, there was a proposal made to City Hall in Copenhagen that bikes in particular were a nuisance on the street and needed to be removed from the street to make room for more cars.